What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We are living in the United States of America, but in truth, states have frequently gone their different ways. Same is true now with COVID-19 and how and when to unwind from lockdown. There are states where all but essential businesses like grocery stores are still shuttered. And then there are states like Georgia forging ahead where you can eat in a restaurant again or get a haircut. While many states are now easing restrictions on businesses, none have yet met the White House's recommendation for a 2-week decline in coronavirus cases before reopening. So this hour on Point, we're going to take a look at four states that are trying to lurch back to an opened economy and the health concerns that come along with that. And we will begin in Georgia. Rose Scott joins us. She's host of NPR station WABE's Closer Look, and she's with us from Atlanta. Rose, welcome to On Point.
Meghna, thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
It's really wonderful to have you. So first of all, tell us, what have you seen in Atlanta, in Georgia, over the past couple of days in terms of, quote unquote, reopening the state?
I think what I've seen and heard from not only from guests, but just from people who I interact with in my own neighborhood, that's if you dissect the timeline of Georgia's reopening its businesses, and depending on whom you ask, you either it reflects confusion or great insight from our Governor Brian Kemp. Governor Brian Kemp issues a shelter-in-place order for all of Georgians April 2nd, April 30th. That order is pretty much relifted, and then in between, you can go get a haircut or go bowling or, you know, some restaurants did reopen. So depending on whom you ask, you get a lot of different, reflections. I've spoken to business owners who did open up and some who said, you know what, we're just not ready yet, because they wanted to follow a more, authentic validation for opening. Mm-hmm. So as some will say, we're just going to follow the science. And that's exactly what a lot of mayors within Georgia have been sort of conflicted, because they're following the science, so to speak, and it's total opposition of what they feel Governor Brian Kemp has been doing.
Right. So talk to me more about that. I mean, you're in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Is there that divide between Atlanta and the state? Do you feel that pull right there?
I think that, well, the divide is between the leaders. Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms has been very vocal about her concern for, you know, people's safety. A number of times she has said she would prefer that folks really adhere to the social distancing guidelines. She has expressed her frustration with residents, as well as being sort of baffled, as she told me in one of our segments, by Governor Kemp's decision to allow some businesses to reopen. So there is that. Also, you go to the southern part of the state, near Tybee Island, where I've been speaking with the mayor down there, Mayor Shirley Sessions, who has a population that has a high percentage of older individuals. And her concern was that when the governor even reopened beaches after she had said, you know, to her community, no, let's modify this. And so depending on where you are, I mean, local governments have been sort of caught in the middle between the governor's actions and actions of their own, and as they feel, to protect their own communities.
Mm. Well, let's listen to what Governor Kemp said at a press conference on Thursday. He, as you noted, Rose, he began lifting restrictions April 30th last month, and here he is last week.
As I have said many times before, we must protect both the lives and the livelihoods of all Georgians. There are many people today who literally cannot afford to put food on the table. We must fight for both the public and economic health of our state.
That's Governor Kemp of Georgia on Thursday. Now, Rose, he was talking there about the well-being of all Georgians, but I'd like to explore with you a little bit about the disproportionate impact that Georgia has seen, the impact that COVID-19 has had on different groups of Georgians, because African-Americans in Georgia are suffering from this outbreak at a much higher rate, aren't they, than other groups in the state? Is that right?
Well, that's what the data shows us. And, you know, look, let's be really clear, too, Magna. In terms of disparities when it comes to health and wellness of people of color, this is not new. As a journalist, I can tell you who's covered this for over 20 years. I'm still somewhat baffled when people are alarmed at the disparities when it comes to health conditions in this nation. And obviously, when you have something like a pandemic, you know, doctors will tell you, physicians will tell you, you know, scientists will tell you that it should not be a surprise that there is this disparity in between, you know, those who have been contracting this virus. This was something also that Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms did cite early on in saying that, you know, we know that here in the South, too, with asthma and respiratory issues, that African Americans tend to suffer from that at a higher rate than their white counterparts and other ethnic groups. I've talked to so many physicians, and whether it's from the CDC to, you know, Emory, which has wonderful healthcare experts, as well as the Morehouse School of Medicine, this is nothing new. And so I think for not only Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, but for others, this is a great concern, and they've been sounding the alarm on this for a long time. And when we start seeing the data reflect that, then obviously that causes people to even be more baffled as to why Governor Kemp did allow for businesses to reopen. And I think it's fair also to know that I've spoken to African-American business owners who understand that plight, but also had to reopen for the economics of that.
Right. So it seems to me that, I mean, so the economic impact of this pandemic, there's no one that's coming through unscathed. But in terms of, it's almost like there's a triple whammy amongst African-Americans in Georgia, right? There's the higher incidence of disease and mortality due to COVID-19. There is the economic impact of job losses. And then also, I'm reading here that because so many people of color are the essential workers of economies, that as economies slowly start to open up, they may be the first who are told or requested to go back to work. And as you're noting, Rose, they don't necessarily feel comfortable or safe in doing that.
Well, again, Meghna, that's nothing new. Yeah. I mean, as a journalist, you've covered this and I've covered this. And look, let's be really clear. When we talk about, you know, those conditions under which not all, obviously, but Black Americans in this nation live under, and those tentacles, those quality of life tentacles that we talk a lot about on this program here on Closer Look at WABE, which are healthcare, mm-hmm. workforce development, education, housing, transit. All of that is impacted. And so if you have already, you are lacking access to quality health care, and then this pandemic hits, what do you think the odds are that you, as a person who is of a low income or a marginalized community or in the rural community, regardless of race, what do you think this has, this impact from the COVID-19 pandemic has already doubled, as you put, or tripled mm-hmm. on those individuals? Mm. And we have communities in rural Georgia with some folks have to travel an hour and a half for maybe an OBGYN mm-hmm. or a dentist or mental health resources.
Right. Pre-COVID-19, right?
Absolutely.
I'm seeing here, though, that, for example, the NAACP late last month called on citizens to push back on the governor. Did that happen?
Well, you've had a lot of leaders, whether they're from the faith community, whether they're from their elected officials, whether they are grassroots organizers. You've had a lot of people come together and ask for the governor to reconsider. Just recently, last week, there were more than, I think, 40 national and regional and local organizations here that penned a letter to Governor Kemp. But they wanted more. They wanted to come together to look for solutions to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. Now, I'm not sure if the governor has responded yet to that letter, but that letter was primarily made of a lot of African-American groups and also those from the faith community. I've spoken to faith leaders here of different denominations who have instructed their churches not to reopen, not to open their doors on Sunday. And anyone will tell you, you know, obviously faith and worship in the African-American community is big, just like in any other, for any other ethnic group. So imagine that, too, when you have faith leaders coming out saying, you know what, we need to really be mindful of what this will do for our community.
Mm. Well, there are, as you noted, Rose, there are many Georgians who say that Governor Kemp is doing the right thing. And we were even seeing some news stories after April 30th of the fact that visitors from outside of Georgia started coming into the state once Georgia started opening up, just because they wanted somewhere to go and something to do that seemed closer to normal life. I mean, is there a positive side to the governor starting to open up again, and are businesses seeing an uptick?
Well, listen, I will tell you what I've experienced firsthand, and speaking to a gentleman who owns a barbershop, and he said, Rose, I have six barbers in here, and some of them make from $300 to $500 a day. They have families. Their families rely on their income. I have families. He said, you know, it was a hard decision to obviously have to shut down to begin with. But once Governor Kemp did lift those restrictions, he took it upon himself, according to him, to make sure that his barbershop was going to abide by the social distancing guidelines. They closed their bathroom. They closed their lobby. He said, we were going to take people by appointment. If you just rolled up trying to get a fade, you couldn't do that. You had to wait outside or wait in your car. You know, understand that we all have lived experiences. So mm-hmm. I don't think anyone would say that anyone opening up, they shouldn't, if it's about economics. And everyone didn't get unemployment, their unemployment benefit claims approved. You know, that didn't happen for everybody. Everybody didn't get their PPE loan. Mm-hmm. So on that end, you can understand someone having to make that tough decision. But also, if they're going to implement those CDC guidelines to the best of their ability. Now, the other thing is, Megan, is that everybody didn't adhere to that, because I've been around. I ride around Atlanta, and I see folks not wearing masks. I see folks standing out waiting to get into a business, and they weren't. Definitely they weren't 6 feet apart, and they weren't wearing masks or gloves. That's problematic. And that's problematic for those businesses that have a high African-American customer base, consumer base.
Yeah. Well, Rose Scott is host of A Closer Look with Rose Scott on WABE in Atlanta. Rose, hang on here for just a second, because I want you to stick with me as we check in with a couple of other states as well about how they are slowly unwinding from lockdown, what that looks like, and what the impact might be. So we'll do more of this when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are checking in with four different states across the country about where they are in terms of loosening restrictions on lockdown and what the impact of those changes have been. I'm joined today by Rose Scott. She's host of A Closer Look with Rose Scott on WABE in Atlanta, Georgia. And Rose, I was looking at the numbers, the latest numbers, according to the CDC, of infections and deaths in Georgia. And as of last night, the CDC says there have been 32,590 cases in Georgia and slightly more than 1,400 deaths. And I kept thinking, you know what? I will say this until I am purple in the face, that it doesn't have to be either or, right? It doesn't have to be the economy or lives. That the smartest set of solutions figure out the intelligent way to open up economies for everyone's good, right? And this is why we've been talking day after day, week after week, about the importance of testing and tracing. And of course, states are in charge of the testing and tracing within their borders. So I was wondering what your take on where Georgia is right now on those really important efforts to keep everyone safe while also starting to open up the economy.
Well, and this is something that Governor Brian Kemp just highlighted last week, and also from the Department of Public Health officials here, that there has been an increase. Now they're encouraging all Georgians to be tested. The tracing is very important as well. But there's been Governor Kemp has highlighted the fact that he feels that the state has done a remarkable job in getting more people tested, getting more testing sites. But beyond the testing also is what Georgia probably wants to finally see is a reduction in the number of those confirmed cases, and then obviously the number of hospitalizations, which is well over, I believe, 5,000 at this point. Actually, it's over 6,000, excuse me. So, you know, couple that with the fact that Georgia was among those states that they really said, you know what, y'all need to stop and wait till you meet these specific, criteria before opening up. But the way the governor sees it, you know, Georgia is on track to possibly reduce the number of infections. But as you all both know, there's this, 14-day period where, you find today, but then next week what happens? And, you know, we've been trying to figure out whether or not Georgia will still hit this so-called surge or spike. And I think depending on, again, who you ask, we just don't know.
Yeah. I'm seeing a report here from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that says that there may not be enough tracers in Georgia to do the work.
There's a hiring push.
Yeah. Oh, there's a hiring push. That's good to hear. Okay.
Yeah, there's a hiring push. We'll be fair about that.
Okay. Well, so and actually, to be fair, I don't know if there's a single state that has enough tracers just yet to do that very important work. But Rose, stand by here for just a second, because now let's turn briefly to South Carolina, and let's listen to South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster. On Friday, he announced that as of today, May 11th, restaurants in South Carolina can open up for dine-in service, although some physical distancing restrictions will still be in place.
We are trying to do the best we can to see that the people of South Carolina suffer as little as possible. And that means that we must get back to work, must get back to this prosperity that has been ours, but we must do, and must do so quickly, but we must do so safely.
South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster on Friday. And joining us now from Columbia is Gavin Jackson. He's public affairs reporter and host of South Carolina ETV's public affairs show, The Week in South Carolina, and the South Carolina Lead podcast. Gavin, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Meghna, great to be here.
It's good to have you. Now, South Carolina was one of the later states to impose any restrictions and then lifted them not long thereafter. So, I mean, has there been a big change over the past couple of days?
Meghna, I'd say it was a gradual approach. That's what our governor was really looking to do, a gradual approach into this situation, a gradual approach out. It did kind of take a while for him to really, you know, get that work or home order in place. A lot of people were like kind of hounding him on it in the beginning. It had been in place for about a month before they lifted it in early May, and that was because he's seen results are saying that they're seeing cases go down. Cases have been declining. And I just want to actually point out before we kind of get into the details about how we're different from Atlanta and Georgia specifically, is that, you know, the state of South Carolina, the population of our state is, I think, a little bit over 5 million. When you compare that to Metro Atlanta, that's, I mean, Metro Atlanta is the size of our state of South Carolina when it comes to population. So a little bit different here, a little bit different approach, a little bit more gradual approach. We have seen, you know, the beaches were closed because people weren't following orders in the beginning. We saw restaurants closed as a precaution. We saw schools closed and remain closed. And now things are gradually reopening back up, like you're talking about. Beaches have reopened. The local governments have the ability to reopen the beaches if they wish. Most of them have done that, specifically Myrtle Beach, especially Myrtle Beach. But even when you look at places like Myrtle Beach, yes, they've lifted the bans on hotels and short-term rentals, so people can come to Myrtle Beach if they want to. But what they're seeing is that occupancy is already going to be down. They're putting restrictions in place for that. And even when you get to Myrtle Beach, there's not much to do besides go to the beach. I mean, obviously, restaurants are back open, so the people can go out to eat. They can go on the boardwalk and such. But the attractions that make places like Myrtle Beach are still closed. You can't even go in the pool in your hotel because that's closed under the governor's order. So some things are open, but it's not necessarily business as usual. It's just business as the new normal, I guess.
Okay. Alas, no magic wand yet. But you're there in Columbia, which, of course, I mean, there's the University of South Carolina right there. And we've talked about the, as of today, restaurants will, in South Carolina, according to Governor McMaster, may open for dine-in service. I mean, those are really important sort of social hubs for any city. Have you seen a difference there?
For sure. And, you know, like we saw outside dining open last week. So, again, another gradual approach, these baby steps. They actually didn't want to open in dining restaurants for Mother's Day weekend because they were fearful of a big surge. And that, you know, I think that was some again, looking at some, you know, details and some metrics as to how that could happen. But what we saw on the outside dining was that we saw people kind of flocking to the bars and the restaurants in neighborhoods near the University of South Carolina, obviously a very big college town. So much so that the places were overrun to a point. They had to have people waiting outside due to capacity issues. Those people weren't social distancing. Places closed early. So there have been, I mean, again, it's very early. People are learning how to do this. We've seen businesses now expand their outside dining options. Again, they are guidelines that are in place for the in-dining that is out today. They don't necessarily have to follow these guidelines because they are just guidelines. They're not mandates. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about 50% capacity in dining restaurants. And we're talking about spacing tables apart and not having condiments on tables and things like that. But really what it's going to come down to is whether these businesses actually follow these rules, whether people feel comfortable going back to these places and follow the guidelines in place for their own security and safety. But you go around, I mean, just like your previous guest was saying, you don't necessarily see people with masks on, with gloves on. I was out recently just looking around at some late night places and, you know, people are sitting right next to you. People aren't covering themselves. They don't worry about talking to you. There's groups of eight or more at a table. So it's really, you know, it's going to be up to the people to decide, you know, if they're going to want to exist in this new normal if they want to do it safely.
Right. And the new normal is so different from place to place, right? I mean, Gavin, listening to you describe people gathering at restaurants and sitting next to each other with no masks. I mean, from my perspective, my point of view here in Massachusetts, that sounds like another planet right now, to be perfectly honest. And I'm not making any judgments. I'm just saying, like, it's so different from place to place across the country.
And it's in the state, too. I mean, not everything is this, but, you know, there are, you know, people are a little bit more maybe not as aware of things that they should be doing. But you go to grocery stores, it's different. Pretty much everyone has a mask on at a grocery store. You know, some places like Costco require people to have masks on, which I think should be the new norm in terms of restoring some confidence to people, which is the big issue. But you hear from these businesses, and we saw a business survey from our Chamber of Commerce in the state where one of the biggest concerns was that a lot of these businesses don't have the PPE to make people feel comfortable there. So it is kind of confusing how they're going to be reopening in some of these places if they don't have enough protection equipment for those employees and for those customers.
Yeah, so talk to me.
That's, I think, the challenge going forward.
That I was going to ask you about exactly that because, you know, we can get the snapshot of today from all of you, but the real question is, you know, what happens today that leads to what the infection rates might be 14 days from now. So you're saying that some businesses are concerned that they don't have enough protective equipment. I mean, has there been any move from local or state level officials to try and procure more or a response to that?
The big procurement moves right now have been really to get PPE for hospitals in the state. We've even seen some private citizens, some business owners actually negotiate to get huge shipments of PPE in from from other countries. But I was talking about this one survey we saw from the Chamber of Commerce. They talked about 5,000 business owners in late April, early May, and 40% said they're concerned about being able to acquire PPE. And then another 64% said they're worried about workplace safety liability issues. So there's going to be some debate in the coming week when our legislature returns about, you know, so-called safe harbor laws in terms of limiting liability on employers. You know, if someone, you know, if a customer or an employee becomes sick with COVID-19, how that could be opening them up for litigation going forward. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it'll be a heavy lift because tort reform is always a heavy lift, regardless of whether you're in the middle of a pandemic or in a good year in the legislative session. So it's not really clear how that's going to work out, but there's concern out there about this. And I guess it goes down to, you know, the individual business owner being able to get those supplies that they need.
And one last question for you, Gavin, about testing and tracing. Where is South Carolina on those?
So we're seeing a ramp up again. It seems like everything's kind of working in concert here as we're slowly reopening. We are also ramping up testing rates in the state. So far, we've had about 7,653 cases, 331 deaths. And when we were talking about the hospitalizations, you look at Georgia, I think it was mentioned in the thousands, we have about 440 people hospitalized here. So really kind of drastic change between the two states right next to each other. And when you look at people, our Department of Health is also saying that about 81% of the first 5,000 cases, those people have recovered. So when you start looking at those numbers, I think there's some encouraging news there. But again, this is all, you know, based on the fact that people are following social distancing guidelines and doing what they need to do. I think that's going to be the biggest challenge going forward, because you see people being lax about it. You see people kind of acting like, okay, well, the work at home order is lifted. Things are plateauing here. We can kind of keep doing what we were doing before, but it's going to be critical to make sure that that people adapt to this new normal. And so we're seeing a big push by our state health department to do to test about 220,000 people in the next 2 months. So, like, to date, we've had about 85,000 tests done. Mm-hmm. Now they want to do 220 in the next 2 months, which is going to be a heavy lift. And a big push of that is going to be testing all the workers and all the residents of the state's nursing homes, because that's been a big concern. So they're going to test 40,000 residents and workers just to get an idea and to see how things are going there and get some better data on this disease as it spreads.
Yeah. Well, Gavin Jackson is public affairs reporter and host of South Carolina ETV's public affairs show, The Week in South Carolina. And he's joined us today from Columbia. Gavin, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Magna.
Rose, thanks for being patient there and listening to Gavin. Just wanted to quickly ask you if you had any sort of responses or reaction to what he was saying was happening in South Carolina.
Well, I think there should be some distinction made in terms of, as he mentioned, the hospitalizations. And a big part of that also, and I want to give just an example, the N95 mask. You know, I was in a neighborhood where one of those little food marts, they had them. And they were $5 a piece. Now, for some people, regardless of what community they live in, that's a lot of money, you know, for that. And I know that folks, if they could get a mask, they probably would. But there are some economics related to that as well. Here in the Atlanta area, and there's part of Atlanta in a county called DeKalb County, they have ordered masks for those neighborhoods which have been identified to have a high rate or most vulnerable for COVID-19. So I think the responsibility that the governments, the local and state governments have, and also, you know, ordering and gathering those PPE, not just for those on the front lines and in the healthcare in that industry, but also for just the communities. That's so important. Now, the governor did mention last week that the state had its largest shipment of personal protective equipment that was going to be shipped to, you know, hospitals and testing sites. And that's great. You know, but also understand, too, for some folks, the reason why they don't have a mask is because they don't have access to get one, or quite frankly, they can't afford it. Right. And if someone listening thinks, well, it's just $5, let me tell you something. When you are someone of low means, regardless of race or ethnic, whatever, that means a lot, because that can mean a meal for you or it can mean a mask.
Yeah. Well, let's move now then to Iowa. And here is Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. She met with President Trump and the White House Coronavirus Task Force last Wednesday. And the governor was asked how meatpacking plants in her state are protecting workers from COVID-19.
We are seeing the supply chain open up. Appreciate what the administration has done to make sure that they have the adequate PPE to protect their employees. You know, this is their teammates. This is an essential workforce. They know how important it is to take care of their workforce. And a big part of it was providing them the confidence to go back into the facility knowing that they'd either tested positive and they'd recovered or they were on a shift with other employees that had tested negative.
That's Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. And joining us now from Des Moines is Clay Masters, lead political reporter and Morning Edition host at Iowa Public Radio. Clay, it's good to have you back on the show.
Good to be back. Thanks.
So first of all, let's talk about the employees in Iowa's meatpacking plants. I mean, we've been hearing about hundreds and hundreds of people getting sick there. What's the latest on that?
The latest is that many of these plants have closed and have done deep cleans to try to make it so workers can return. They're putting in the acrylic barriers, the plastic barriers between workstations. I mean, I was at before I was in Iowa, I was based in Nebraska and toured a meatpacking plant some 10 years ago. And I remember the first time I walked in to one of these facilities and your eyes kind of just have to adjust to the room. I mean, you cannot socially distance in a meatpacking plant because you're literally shoulder to shoulder almost next to the people beside you. So you can, I definitely was remembering this when these reports were first coming out that people were being infected in these meatpacking plants is that there's just nowhere to go. You're right next to someone, and it's just row after row of people cutting, working on whatever kind of meat it is that is produced in those facilities. So they've been closing down, deep cleaning, some reopen, people come back, and it's something that we continue to watch. And this is one of those, in addition to the long-term care facilities, this is one of those places across the state where we are seeing a lot of outbreaks.
Mm. Well, Governor Reynolds, though, I believe has been talking, or no, actually, let me get this right. The Vice President Mike Pence has been talking about Iowa as a success story in the nation's battle against COVID-19. Is that view shared amongst the sort of medical experts in Iowa?
No. Kim Reynolds, the governor, said recently, a couple weeks ago, the reality is that we cannot stop the virus, that it will remain in our communities until a vaccine is available. And instead, we must learn to live with the COVID-19 virus activity without letting it govern our lives. Now, infectious disease experts, as she started reopening parts of the economy, they have said that the state is not ready for this. And that it appears that hotspots, are isolated these places. But that's where most of the testing is happening. And so there were also concerns that researchers at the University of Iowa had warned the governor's administration that they should keep mitigation efforts in place. But Governor Reynolds is continuing to reopen and says that, there's enough capacity in hospitals with ICU beds to have an increase in people with COVID-19 symptoms and being treated.
That's what she says, but it sounds like there may be some doubt about that or at least concerns about that. So, Clay, hang on here for just a second. And Rose Scott, hang on as well. We just have to take another quick break. We'll be right back. We're checking in with states across the country and how they are slowly opening up. This is On Point.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be talking about evictions and rent insecurity in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. And renters, we want to hear your stories. How are you dealing with making rent during this time, especially if you're out of work as well? And landlords, especially small landlords, what's your reaction to the movement to cancel rent, about the eviction protections that are in place in certain states? And can we come up with solutions that are good for everyone, for renters, for landlords, and the communities that they all live in? So leave us a voicemail at 617-353-3333. 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are checking in with a number of states across the country about where they are in loosening restrictions on their economies or on state, say, at-home restrictions, and what that might mean for the next step, the next 14 days or so in each of these places. And Rose Scott joins us. She's host of A Closer Look with Rose Scott from WABE in Atlanta. And Clay Masters is also with us. He's lead political reporter at Iowa Public Radio. And Clay, just pick up on the thought that you left us with before the break about hospital capacity. I presume that might be true in places like Des Moines, but is it uniformly true across Iowa?
Well, Governor Kim Reynolds is pointing to that and saying that, you know, there's enough capacity. But we're seeing reports of, like, Sioux City, which is in northwest Iowa, Woodbury County. That's where one of the biggest hot spots in the country is. That's where there is a meatpacking plant just across the river in Nebraska, in Dakota City, Nebraska. We were hearing reports late last week that a hospital in Sioux City was moving COVID-19 patients out of their hospital to nearby hospitals to get ready for more. So what we're really seeing is that infectious disease experts, what their concerns are, aren't always squaring up very closely with what Governor Kim Reynolds' expectations are or where she says things are. And infectious disease experts are definitely saying in the state that we have not flattened the curve in Iowa. And every day you see hundreds of new confirmed cases and several deaths are being reported. But the governor's tone has very much shifted. I mean, she even said late last week that she's shifting the focus of Iowa's coronavirus response to talk more about the economy and is saying that Iowans should be proud of the response that is taking place here.
Okay. Well, Iowa has been visited by several very high-profile members of the Trump administration, right? We talked about Vice President Mike Pence, I believe. Has Secretary Mike Pompeo been there recently, or he plans to?
He's actually going to—I mean, this is Iowa, Magna, and I know things didn't go really great for the Democrats with the caucuses this year, but, you know, nobody goes to Iowa accidentally. Pompeo is headlining a faith leader dinner in July, so he hasn't been here yet.
But he's coming. Okay.
That's right.
And the vice president was there just very recently. I mean, is this a testing ground or sort of you need to be seen in Iowa being a positive face on the coronavirus pandemic in order to, you know, make a play for 2024? Is that what we're talking about?
There's definitely some of that going on always here in Iowa. But at the same time, this is also just a stage where the vice president can come meet with our two U.S. senators here in Iowa who are Republicans. Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley were also here with the vice president. Now, this was when on Friday their flight got delayed to come out here because the press secretary for the vice president had tested positive for coronavirus. Mm-hmm. She wasn't coming out on this trip, but Governor Reynolds had just been at the White House on Wednesday of last week. And we were also hearing reports last night from Bloomberg News that Governor Kim Reynolds was considering whether or not to self-isolate herself. And we are hearing this morning that her press conference at 11 o'clock is going to be dial-in only, which indicates that we don't have it confirmed yet, but there might be some news here about whether or not the governor is self-isolating because of coming in contact with the vice president's staff or somebody who tested positive.
Well, we will talk more about that in a couple of minutes here. But Clay Masters, lead political reporter for Iowa Public Radio, thank you so much, Clay.
Good to talk to you. Thank you. You're welcome.
Okay, so let's check in with one last state here, the great state of Texas. Here's Texas Governor Greg Abbott speaking to the press from the White House with President Trump on Thursday. Governor Abbott was asked about the role of police in enforcing lockdown and physical distancing orders.
We should not be taking these people and put them behind bars. These people who have spent their life building up a business and being told to shut it down and lose every penny they have, and then if they don't follow every little, you know, fine point of all the rules, they suddenly are subject to arrest. That is wrong. And that's why I issued another executive order today saying that instead of Texas, no one could be put behind bars because they're not following an executive order.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott on Thursday. And joining us now from Houston is Luis Carrasco, editorial writer and member of the Houston Chronicle's editorial board. Luis, welcome back to the program.
Hello. Great to be back. Thank you.
So where is Texas in terms of opening up?
Well, we are, if you listen to the governor, we are at 25 capacity. That's the percentage that he allowed for restaurants, movie theaters, and retail stores to open on May 1st. This Friday, barbershops, hair salons, tanning salons were allowed to open up. And it's believed that as early as this week, we might go up to 50% capacity. But if you look at, you know, people on the streets, cars on the highway, it looks like, you know, we're at 100% capacity already. It's quite shocking.
Wow. Now, you know, a little earlier, Rose was telling us in Georgia that there's some concern at the city level, for example, that city leaders may not want to open up as quickly as state leaders might. Are you seeing that same tension in Texas?
Yes, most definitely. I think that along with, you know, the coronavirus threat, this has turned into a fight over local control, which is a common theme here in Texas. You know, when it comes to the federal government versus the state, Texas, the Republican officials are all about local control. Once it's the state of Texas versus counties and cities, it really becomes more what the state wants to do. And you see it all across Texas. You know, all the cities, the counties want to keep more restrictions in place. There was a big fight between County Judge Lena Hidalgo in Houston and the lieutenant governor, who specifically pointed out her restrictive order, you know, demanding masks of people and offering fines and up to jail time. And, you know, that's been this constant clash with the governor basically saying that they are going to, the state's power, you know, takes precedence over anything that localities have to do.
Okay, so just to be clear, Luis, if I want to be sure I'm understanding you correctly, so the state has basically taken all the teeth out of whatever any local leader might put, restrictions she or he might put on their locality.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, local leaders are asking people to continue to wear masks, but it's more of an ask now because the governor has taken away, you know, the power to fine, the power to put people in jail if they disregard these orders. So, you know, it's up to personal responsibility, which I guess is a very Texas thing to do. But you see it on the street that personal responsibility is in short supply for a lot of people.
Meaning what? Tell me more.
Meaning that, you know, the idea is we recommend wearing face masks. And even though, you know, you look at some places like grocery stores, people are very good at wearing the face mask. Other places where people are just in public, you know, they're going maskless, if you will, which is very troubling, especially since, you know, we're opening up more and more. And yet we are not, as was pointed out earlier, we are nowhere near the guidelines that are supposed to be there before a state can open up. So,
guidelines in terms of that 14-day decline in the number of cases. And what about as we've been talking with everyone else here, the tandem importance of testing and tracing? Where is Texas on testing?
You know, for a long time, Texas was at the bottom of the list on states as far as testing. We really got out of the gate fairly late on that. And that's improving, definitely. And we're seeing that in the number of cases. Sunday was the sixth straight day that we had more than 1,000 new cases reported. And during the last 2 weeks, we've had about 40% of deaths have occurred during the past 2 weeks. So it's tough to square the idea that we're opening up just as we seem to be getting, you know, more cases, more deaths. The state, the argument that they make is that they're looking at, well, obviously we have more tests and we're getting more cases, and that makes sense. But, you know, those numbers are for the state to see alone. They get reported about once a week. So we can't really check their math on how that's going.
Hmm. Well, Luis Carrasco, editorial writer and member of the Houston Chronicle's editorial board, with us from Houston. Luis, it was great to have you back on the show again. Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Now, Rose, in a moment, I'm going to jump over to Washington to get sort of the latest on what the Trump administration is doing about states opening up. But I wanted to ask you one last question, and that is we've been hearing across this hour about, I mean, Clay was the most specific about it in Iowa, that some governors are trying to sort of shift the focus now to reopening, to living with coronavirus in a new way, to trying to find a new normal. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the shifting of that focus now.
I think, to be fair, because for me as a journalist, you know, we try to, for our audience, we try to be that interpreter of what our elected officials may be thinking. Look, you could take one aspect of this and say, well, just look at the recent tax revenue loss that Georgia revealed, you know, for April, the total nearly $1.84 billion for a decrease of over a billion. And that's less than, that's 35% compared to April 2019. I would never suggest that was the motivating factor for the governor to make his decision. I think that would be unfair. But I think that you will have people who will say that, is there an attempt to put profit over people? On the other hand, you have folks that says, you know what, we recognize, or the administration recognizes, that we have to get Georgians back to work. And if we can suggest or enforce people to adhere to social distancing guidelines and maybe provide the PPE that they need, then maybe we can adjust to whatever this new normal is. And just before we go, I think it's also important to understand that there are demographics that we haven't talked about that are still at a high risk. And those are folks who work in Georgia's poultry industry. Mm-hmm. You know, Georgians love to be the capital of this, and Georgia's considered the poultry capital. You know, and those workers, you know, so you have to take all that into consideration. If you're talking about putting Georgians back to work, it means putting all Georgians back to work and making sure that you can ensure their safety.
Right. That's and I'm so glad you pointed that out, because we can't say it enough. It doesn't have to be either or. That, like, we have to collectively find a way to do both at the same time. So Rose Scott, host of A Closer Look with Rose Scott on WABE, with us from Atlanta. Rose, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you, Meghna. I appreciate it.
All right. As promised, let's wrap up today in Washington. And Kimberly Atkins is there. She's WBUR's senior news correspondent. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Meghna.
So we wanted to talk with you because, as you heard Clay Masters mentioned a little earlier, there's COVID in the West Wing of the White House. What is the latest on that?
Yeah, so several White House officials are self-isolating today after several members of the staff within the White House tested positive, including Vice President Mike Pence, Press Secretary Katie Miller. So we know that the Vice President himself sort of self-isolated in his home over the weekend, but he is expected to be back in the White House today as the White House readies new plans on testing. But there's a lot of concern within the White House about managing the virus among its own staff, let alone putting out policy as these states begin to reopen.
I mean, so the White House now experiencing firsthand what workers across the country, businesses across states across the country have been dealing with for some time. And just so I'm sure I understand sort of what the White House's current response has been, I think I read somewhere that there's no plans for to keep the president and the vice president apart or physically distant for as long as they're dealing with this West Wing outbreak. Is that right?
That is right. They are both at the White House today. You know, CDC guidelines, their own administration says when you come in contact with someone, you should self-isolate for 14 days. Neither the president nor the vice president has done that. They are both there today with other people. And you have seen an increase of people wearing masks and such within the White House, but they themselves usually do not. So they have not been following the CDC guidelines, as they are the face of this response. And part of that is not by accident. The president himself has said that he, you know, if he's told to wear a mask, he would, but that he wouldn't. And certainly his messaging has focused on reopening the country, the need to reopen the country and protect the economy. And to that end, wearing a mask perhaps is seen as counter to that, even though health experts are unanimous that that is an important part of any reopening, that you take mitigating steps, including wearing masks and social distancing, in order to do it safely.
Look, I'm just going to say it. We have protocols around the safety of the president and the vice president for a reason. There are separate airplanes. They're not supposed to be in the same place in the midst of a disaster. I mean, there's a chain of command for a reason, to protect the leaders of this country. And it is a little concerning to hear that even as we know COVID-19 is in the White House, that they don't have any plans on being in separate places. So I'm just going to say that out loud. You don't have to comment on it, Kimberly, at all. Okay, we just got about 30 seconds left here. I'm wondering if there's any news or insight that you have about what's going on in Congress regarding another aid package, or where the minds of congressional leaders are.
Yeah, so the House is taking the lead this time. Last time it was the Senate, and putting forth the next round of relief, which would include $1 trillion for state and local aid. That is something that is being rebuffed by both leaders in the Senate and the White House. So we'll have to see where those talks go.
All right. Well, Kimberly Atkins, WBUR senior news correspondent, with us from the nation's capital, from Washington. Kimberly, thank you so very much.
Always a pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.